You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 30th of November to the 6th of December 2017. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by reporters Jack Grove and Ellie Bothwell, and the Higher Education Journalist of the Year, Holly Els. Congratulations. Our cover feature this week looks at research authorship. Have you ever felt slighted by a more senior colleague over an author credit whose name should appear first on a paper? Have you ever accepted author credit when you know full well you didn't deserve it? Holly has been putting all these questions and more to hundreds of academics, and this week she reveals the results of her survey. Is uncertainty over South Africa's HE funding system pushing the country's universities to crisis point? Jack has the latest on that. And finally, is one university's biblically consistent curriculum too restrictive? Ellie has been speaking to staff at Cedarville University in Ohio, which has told staff to avoid using erotic material, R-rated movies, or films with too much swearing as part of their lectures. But first, to that survey, Holly. You've been speaking to people about the free-for-all, the stress and skullduggery in the race for first authorship.
Yeah, so this is obviously a really important issue for many academics. You know, everybody needs research papers to progress their career. So we're looking at basically what happens in this fraught area of authorship in terms of who gets their name on a paper, which position in the author list your name gets to, and the squabbles and feuds that can occur over these decisions. I guess this is all so important because academic papers have become so important to researchers' careers. They define, you know, whether you get a promotion, if you get invited to talk about your research at a conference, for example, and also, you know, increasingly universities are assessed on the quality of their research using metrics around papers, and each individual researcher has a part to play in that. So I guess with all of these things, where there's sort of decisions that have to be made, there's also the potential for abuse to occur. And as one of the people I spoke to for the feature told me, she said essentially some senior researchers are eating their young in terms of taking advantage of their juniority to sort of put themselves in a higher position when the more junior person is the one who actually rightfully deserves to be there. They've done all the research and they should be getting the credit for the paper. So we did a bit of a poll really to look at what actually happens in reality when people are deciding, you know, who gets to go where on a big research paper or a small research paper.
An anonymous poll, we should say. Bluntly honest about the kind of practices that they experience.
Yeah, we wanted to take a look at what was actually happening. It's all very well we know what should be happening, but what does actually happen? And we found some really interesting stuff. So about two-thirds of the people who answered the poll, there was about 350 of them, said that they had sort of been done over by someone more senior when it comes to an authorship credit, which is quite shocking, really. That's quite a high figure, people saying that they've, you know, at some point in their career, been treated unfairly. And a third said that they had been offered a credit on a paper when they didn't necessarily deserve it. And this can happen when you know, somebody wants to add a bit more gravitas to their paper. Maybe they're going to put someone who's really respected in the field, even if they had no involvement in the work.
And 16% of those offered a credit who felt they didn't deserve it actually accepted it as well.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a cutthroat world, isn't it? I suppose you're not going to turn your nose up at
it. It is. And I guess there's also a bit of this attitude, well, if someone else is doing it, then why can't I not do it? So I encourage you to go and look at the feature, and there's lots of great graphs there. A really interesting one on page 36 that looks at what people think should qualify them for an authorship credit, and then what they actually have experienced in terms of what they have been given an authorship credit for.
Indeed. Well, you can read that, as Holly says, on page 36 and the surrounding pages in the magazine. You'll also, of course, find it on timeshighereducation.com. Check it out there, where you can also leave comments maybe on your own experiences of this issue. The lead news story this week, Jack, over to you, is about South Africa. Now, the last couple of years, lots of news coverage about South Africa, very high-profile student protests. Been a bit quiet maybe more recently on our pages, but you've sort of been looking into what the situation is right now in South Africa.
Yeah, it's quite an extraordinary situation, really. The South African university year is coming to a close, and the new term will start in early February, but no one's really been able to plan for the coming year because there's been deep cuts in state funding, and normally universities would raise their fees to compensate for this, but they can't because there's quite militant student unions in South Africa who have said that they will cause trouble, as they did last year.
Yeah, so, emboldened by their success. Yeah,
and so they can't. Universities are facing some pretty tough decisions to make. In fact, they can't really make a decision because they can't raise fees. They have to freeze them. The cuts will mean that the sort of research resource means probably that they'll have to cut staff numbers. At the same time, you've got quite an interesting national situation where they were unsure about the long-term situation of funding, so they had a commission. The commission reported, instead of saying, well, look at this, these plans for an income contingent loan system, a bit like the UK, Jacob Zuma says we might actually have free tuition for the poorer students. Mm. So quite sort of bizarre and interesting higher education situation going on there. There's a million students in South Africa, so it's quite a lot.
Is there a risk that kind of the violence that we've seen in recent years could return if they don't play their cards well on these particular issues?
Yeah, very much so. I think an interesting situation was at the University of Cape Town, where students had to sit their final year exams in a huge marquee on the rugby field. This marquee was ringed by a security fence, riot police with guard dogs going around just to stop activists just disrupting the final examinations, because that's how fraught and volatile the situation is on campus.
A tricky situation. And also on that front spread, Holly, you write about Zimbabwe, another sub-Saharan African story. It's obviously a very high-profile news story at the moment, with Mugabe stepping down. What's going on in the world of higher education over there?
Well, we spoke to some Zimbabwean academics who no longer reside in the country and one who does, and the general feeling is really that some pretty big changes need to be made in order for universities to rebuild themselves after what has been 37 years of quite a brutal regime. I guess one of the things which is key on people's mind is this PhD in sociology that Mr. Mugabe's wife Grace was awarded from the University of Zimbabwe just 2 months after she enrolled. I mean, you can't really get a PhD in 2 months, as far as I know, but maybe she's a super scholar, who knows?
Why are you so cynical? Who knows?
So, a couple of people saying really that needs to be rescinded to sort of show a symbol of to what is to come for universities in Zimbabwe now.
Mm, worth noting, of course, that Robert Mugabe, I think, was Chancellor of that university at the time.
He was, yes.
Indeed, I'll leave it there for now. You can read about that. We've also had some blogs from scholars who have studied Zimbabwe. You can search our website for Zimbabwe to bring up all those stories and more. Finally, Ellie, over to you. You've been speaking to scholars and people associated with Cedarville University in Ohio. It's recently implemented what it terms a biblically consistent curriculum policy. What's it all about?
Yes, so this is a new policy that the institution launched early this year, which basically restricts the kind of material that faculty can teach the students. So I should point out that this is a private sort of Christian university, and the policy says that faculty should avoid material that's clearly pornographic, erotic, obscene. It should avoid plays, dramatic scripts that have swearing, R-rated movies, that's films that, you need to be age 17 to watch. And there are it was very difficult to speak to people at the institution currently there at the moment. I've been told that there are kind of fears among many of the scholars in humanities about speaking out and what that means for their jobs. But
and indeed, I know while you were researching this piece, we sort of most universities list contact details on websites, don't they? Whereas a lot of the staff, all the staff at Cedarville aren't reachable directly.
Yes, yeah, it was kind of through contact forms on the university's website, some of which it seemed to doesn't necessarily go immediately to them. So it was quite difficult. But I spoke to a few scholars who have, one of whom left early this year and one who left a few years ago. And there were kind of two main kind of concerns really with the policy. One is just the kind of academic freedom of the fact that faculty can't choose the kind of material they teach. Mike Lopez, who left in May, said that that staff now have to kind of make sure that material is approved by a department chair or dean. Mm. And then the other is the fact that if students at this university aren't kind of learning a range of material, what kind of graduates are they going to be when they come out of the system? Are they going to be too sheltered? Are they going to kind of understand the world? The university's response to this is that it doesn't restrict conversation about other people's views. It says we talk about the whole kind of spectrum of views that people had. It's just we don't then want to show a play or talk about a specific book that might hurt students' feelings. It's interesting in terms of the kind of wider debate because it's obviously not just Christian colleges in the US that are having these issues. There are lots of secular institutions that are now also putting trigger warnings on material that may be attempted to remove certain literature that might be deemed offensive and kind of where can you draw the line on that?
Indeed, it's an interesting story. You'll find it on page 20. I beg your pardon, page 15 of the magazine, and also on the website as well at timeshighereducation.com. On a related note, in our comment section this week, we have a piece from Felipe Fernandez Armesto, who is the William P. Reynolds Professor of History at the University of Notre Dame in the US. He's writing on how it's discriminatory to assume that religion is a barrier to academic or professional judgment, obviously closely related to the issues discussed in Ellie's piece. That's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast. If you want to comment on anything we've discussed, or indeed anything in the magazine or online, you can do so at timeshighereducation.com, you can do so on Twitter, and you can do so on LinkedIn and Facebook as well. Well, that's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.